Warning, the following discussion will contain references to suicide that some people may find sensitive or triggering.
Hey, I'm Katie J, and welcome to a brand new podcast from Young Scot and Capital Scotland. In this series, we talk about the stuff that matters the most to you, whether it be online safety, LGBTQ plus issues, or COVID concerns. So let's get into episode 3 of Young Scotcast. And today we're focusing on mental health and talking about making your mental health a priority. Firstly, your feelings are valid. And if you're struggling with them right now, this episode will hopefully allow you to realise that you're absolutely never alone. We'll give you positive and practical tips on what you can do to help lessen any negative feelings or thoughts, and also how you can identify when your pals might need some help. As always, I'm joined by someone who has first-hand experience on the topic. It's Fergus Crawley.
Hello.
I've heard your story previously before, but it's just so wonderful to have the chance to kind of sit down and talk to you about this stuff, because you do speak so openly, so honestly, and so brilliantly about this topic. You came out the other side of a negative experience with mental health. Before we get on to how you turn things around, are you okay to talk to us about what happened?
Yeah, so I'll be as concise as I can, but I'll apologise in advance. I'll probably fail. For context, I was almost expelled from my first school when I was about 14, 15. I can't even remember. It's a bit of a blur because I wasn't doing very much other than falling asleep in class and playing Modern Warfare 2, like most children my age were. But I left school into a new environment, new friendship group, etc., and quickly learned how to learn. So I went from being a kid that wasn't going to university, had kind of wasted all his prospects. It was frankly insulting to my parents, and that's something that I still reflect on from an analytical sense personally. But I was the missing link in a support network of people wanting the best from me, but I just wasn't giving what was required. Moved schools, learned how to learn, learned a little bit more about what I enjoyed, found a better environment, and then went from being somebody that wasn't going to university at all to being an Oxbridge candidate, which was very exciting. And throughout that process, I became really, really focused on self-development, my health and fitness, my grades, basically just improving myself, because I kind of learned how to enjoy education, learned how to enjoy self-betterment, however you want to phrase it. And part of that process meant that a lot of progress happened really, really quickly, which from a personal perspective, put a lot of weight on my shoulders in terms of how do I keep that trajectory going forwards.
Yeah.
And from an external perspective, it made me seem like I had everything completely together to all my friends. My teachers warned my parents, nobody can continue at this intensity, which was a warning. They were like, oh, what's he talking about? What do you mean? Because they weren't really seeing the first hand. They saw me revising for my exams, they saw me focusing on things, but to them it was just, oh great, he's sort of turned a corner here. So I left.
Oh, they're just proud of you.
Well, I guess it's a better way of saying it, but I didn't get into Oxford. I ended up going to Durham, which is a fantastic university.
Absolutely.
But I hadn't looked around Durham because I'd become so academically and so locked into this like self-development mindset that in my mind, it didn't matter what environment I was in, what city I was in. The only thing that mattered was the best possible university I could go to, which is a very inhuman way of looking at it and is a very damaging mindset to go into, because it made everything very rigid, very black and white. And that's ultimately where things started to fall apart, because the environment dictated my happiness.
Yeah.
And because I hadn't acknowledged that until I arrived, I was put into what I think was an administrational bunch of misfits in terms of the halls of residence, because to my left was an entire hall in a college of Chinese postgraduates, which is obviously completely fine, but I found it very odd that they were segregated like that.
Yeah, yeah.
And then the floor below me were all girls that were from within 15 miles of the university. The floor above me was all people that had done a gap year at university and then changed. So they were 3 years older than I was. And the segregation bothered me, but it basically meant that I was not around like-minded people. They were all lovely people, don't get me wrong, but they weren't like-minded. Wasn't playing a team sport. And then all of a sudden I'd gone from this rapid trajectory upwards where I had this expectation on my shoulders. Other people had those expectations of me. And I felt massively on the back foot. But because I'd been so black and white,
the prospectus didn't cover this.
Correct. But I wouldn't have even looked, because again, best university possible, nothing else matters.
Right.
So when I showed up and realized that actually I was in the situation that I hadn't mentally prepared for, all the rigidity, all the parameters I'd set around, how am I going to approach the next 3 years? I'd mapped out the rest of my life. I was getting this degree so I could get this job to earn this much, to do this, to live here, to all this traditional rubbish. And then all my friends at other universities were having a great time. I was eating dinner on my own 7 nights a week. I was hiding in my room, and then things just got slowly worse and worse. And without sort of giving too much detail, from October 2014, things got steadily worse. I ended up living in Newcastle in second year, because I'd rather live with people that I knew than live on my own in private halls. But what that did was detach me from my university city. So swings and roundabouts. Newcastle was great for a little while, but then exam season rolled around. I was back to being on my own, back to eating on my own, back to doing all these things on my own. And it just got steadily worse. And I've only been retrospectively diagnosed as depressed, because the key element to all of this is that not once, whilst things got steadily worse and more aggressive internally, did I say a word to anyone about how I was feeling, because I was so ashamed and so fearful of being a letdown. Basically, all these expectations and all this upward trajectory that I'd fought to develop for myself, I was at fear of losing, and that would make me a failure. That would make me less of a man. That would make me back to being this insulting, annoying little child that I was to my parents when I wasn't doing any work, et cetera, et cetera. So it was just a perpetual downturn in my head, really, just a spiral that got worse and worse. And that's why I mentioned the word irrational before, because when I try and reflect on it now, the headspace doesn't make any sense. Yeah. And I think that's something that's important to highlight, because so often when people try and understand depression, they try and rationalize it and think, well, X equals Y, Y equals Z, but it doesn't work like that. Understanding it from the top down rather than from the bottom up is the right way to think about it, because retrospectively reflecting on how somebody feels the way they do, maybe isolating what they're missing in their life, what maybe are the things that they're craving, what needs aren't being met, etc., whether it's fulfillment, whether it's social, all these things. But I think society does too much to try and rationalize what ultimately cannot be rationalized. If you'd asked me when I was suffering from depression, did depression even exist? I would have said, no, it's an excuse people can use to avoid responsibility or hard work.
Really?
And then February 2016, I started getting split in half by weights at the gym. I could do my eyes closed. I couldn't sleep. I couldn't eat. I was just exhausted, but then I'd sleep for like 20 hours through alarms, but then I couldn't sleep for 3 days, and it started to affect me very, very drastically physically. And then all of a sudden, you were very wrong. It's very real. It's not something that's a convenient excuse for people. And I learned a very hard lesson very fast, but my fear of being viewed as less of a man was what paralyzed me from actually doing anything about that.
So do you think when it started to, the symptoms started to manifest in physical ways, and the exhaustion, the fatigue, and the kind of, well, that made you sit up and listen more to what was going on? Or
yes and no, in the sense that it made me sit up and listen, and that this is much worse than you thought, which pushed me even further away from even contemplating talking about it, because it made me even more exposed. Like, you're worse than you were, you even worse than you thought, you're even more of a failure than you thought, was how my brain worked back then. But again, looking at it now, I'm like, how on earth did you?
I know, yeah.
Did you think about it that way? But it was a reflection of my mindset at the time. And I think it was a reflection of society at the time, because I mean, I went to an excellent school, which would have had mental health conversations going if it was something that was common in society at the time, but it just wasn't. It was never a conversation until it was too late for me. But now that's not the case, which is great to see. Mm. But I think the environment and the circumstances in which that conversation is happening is even more challenging, because of an ever increasingly demanding pressure on young kids, the pandemic we're in, how we want to fit in social media, the direction we can go in our lives, how we want to spend our time, all this stuff, so much more fluid, which is great because it gives you more freedom to decide who you want to be, but it also makes it even more difficult to decide what direction you want to go in, which can cause anxiety,
there's so much going on. I mean, it's interesting kind of hearing your story about, you know, that trajectory you were on at school and achieve, and I suppose equating your self-worth with those achievements. And then the second you get into brilliant university halls, oh my gosh, I don't think people speak about this enough, because some of my friends lucked out and were in halls with people who are going to be bridesmaid at their wedding. They're that close still.
Yeah.
They are so connected. And I don't speak to anyone that I was in first year of halls with. My producer's laughing. It's not because of me. I'm sure it's their fault. No, it's luck of the draw. And it's really interesting when you speak about that kind of irrational headspace, because I remember similarly sitting in floods of tears and thinking, well, this is it. This was meant to be the best time of my life, and everybody else is doing it right, and I can't.
But that's it, isn't it? You start blaming yourself, and all these little things just push me further and further back, because I'd set a clear plan. I'm still very analytical, but I'm very, very adaptable now. Whereas before, I'd sat there and mapped out how I wanted things to go. And the second I deviated from that, the second I was even 1 degree off that pathway, everything fell apart, and I didn't have any plan B, contingency plans. And all it did was just push me further and further back. And I went from being somebody that could speak to anybody of any age comfortably no issue whatsoever. Not even comfortably. I would have a good conversation, and it'd probably reflect well on me off the back of that conversation, to being genuinely scared of leaving my room in my halls of residence after not even 6 weeks I started feeling like that. And that was 6 weeks into a university course that was meant to last 3 years. And I kept saying, oh, it's only 3 years in the grand scheme of things. But at the same time, they're meant to be some of the best years of your life. And I only enjoyed 1 year of my time at university. And that's not something I'm going to get back. I mean, obviously, I'm very thankful that I'm now much happier, healthier, and self-aware now. But equally, if we can bring that forward so that other kids don't need to miss out on what is ultimately very formative for the rest of your lives, I'd like to think we'll be better off as a society overall, and the general well-being of the Western world will be better.
100%. And also just like not funneling people down a path where you're like, yeah, this is the only path for you, is it's school, it's uni, it's doing this. Actually allowing people to work out what the heck they want to do.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm grateful for it now. I did English literature, but I don't know if I wanted to do English literature.
Well, that's what I wanted to do. But I chose to do theology and religion because it improved my chances of getting to Oxford.
So it was
2,800 people versus 71 people for one place.
Yeah.
So I quite literally went from choosing the thing that I wanted to do to being led down a pathway where actually you could do better if you chose to do something that you didn't want to, which is just so twisted. Because what I should have done upon reflection was sports science at Loughborough, because that's what I was actually fascinated with. But in the school's eyes, Loughborough wasn't as good a university as Oxford or Durham. They're completely arbitrary tables. Most of these things are based on 100 statistics and postgraduate funding and all this stuff that means very little. And in the working world now, as long as you've shown a track record of being able to apply yourself over time in whatever discipline you want, unless you're going to something vocational, like you can't just turn up and be a GP off the back of proving something.
No, but no, that would be terrifying.
It means you can be very fluid in what you want to do. And I think society wants to put people in boxes, and we feel like we need to be placed in boxes, when in reality we're all the best version of being ourselves at any one time. Nobody is better at being you than you, so embrace that and actually allow that to flourish.
So true. And it was something that I wish was just innate in us all. I mean, maybe it is, maybe it's society that like pushes it out.
I think it is, I think so.
You get to a point where it that feels like a really hard thing to grasp, that you are allowed to just be you and follow whatever path makes sense for you. Just going back to your journey, Fergus, and your experience, when did things start to shift, and when did you start to acknowledge what was happening and pull yourself out of that situation?
I'd love to say post-suicide attempt in May of 2016, I came around from that and thought, right, something needs to change. I did, but not to the degree that I'd like to say that it did, because all that did initially was make me more ashamed of myself for having taken one single initiative throughout the entire time that I was suffering, and even that hadn't worked. So it's a pretty sadistic way of looking at things, but that was, in honesty, how I felt. My first feeling was rage, not sadness. It was rage. I was just so furious that I couldn't even, I don't want to use the word succeed because it sounds like it would have been a positive, but you know what I mean? It didn't come off. The plan, I'd set had fallen short. So I lay there for, I mean, I was still pretty intoxicated from the sort of the attempt itself. So I actually was borderline incapacitated for a while, unable to do anything other than just sit there and think, which was very forceful in terms of reflection. But it made me realize that this was more desperate than I'd perhaps allowed myself to realize or acknowledge. I'd known, but I hadn't acknowledged it. I'd been very good at repressing those feelings. And the next couple of days, I honestly can't really remember what my headspace was. I think I just, honestly, it was just like the world's biggest emotional, physical come down of just dump of adrenaline, everything all at once. And it was a bit of a blur. And then I got a text from one of my best friends called Andy, who fully joking, with no expectation of me following through, he was basically just bragging. He said, I'm getting a puppy from this litter next week, you in? I was like, yes. That's exactly what I need. Because just in the back of my head, I just immediately jumped to structure, routine, responsibility, and then most importantly, a heartbeat, a companion. And it was a case of, look at the bank account, can't really afford it. Andy, can I borrow 600 quid to make this happen? Cleared out student loan, just chuck the kitchen sink at it, because in the back of my head, that was what I needed. And then a week later, I had a 14-week-old French bulldog on the train back down from Edinburgh to Newcastle. And overnight, I went from having, in my mind, I mean, I had every reason to continue to exist. I had every reason to wake up in the morning, but in my mind, I didn't feel that I did. I had a reason to get up because I had to take Odie out. And at this point, he refused to walk on concrete. So not only did I have to take Odie out, but I had to grab the closest clothes I could find, chuck on a pair of glasses if I could find them because I wear contact lenses, pick him up in the most mismatched outfit ever, and stroll him about 800 yards down the road to a church patch of grass because he would only walk on grass.
Because you had a baby.
Exactly. I even had a pram. No, I didn't. But it's what happened very quickly was that routine allowed me to just get a bit more energy, a bit more structure to my day. A week or so had passed and that had a huge impact. And then all of a sudden, people know Newcastle. Newcastle's a very, very friendly place. It's why I've come back to Scotland for one of those reasons, just because it's such a friendly place on the whole. And Newcastle's very similar, and that's why I kind of really enjoyed it there. But I was just speaking to people, just hairdressers and jazzmen, that were like, "Oh, how old?" They weren't like giving me psychoanalysis. I was just talking to people again, and that just really, really started to bring me back. And then that allowed me. I went home to Edinburgh that summer, so exam season 2016 was when things were at their worst. Mm-hmm. Then I had a brief period of recovery before the term ended, and then by the time I got home in summer of 2016, I felt in control again. I felt happy to a degree. I was still repressing everything that had happened up until that point, but I was able to function and be happy and enjoy my existence and socialize, and I could kind of sweep it under the carpet for the time being. And then Christmas 2016, my mum had always said she'd never want, my parents were in between moving from Edinburgh back to where they're originally from, which is the Wirral in the northwest of England, which is why I don't have a Scottish accent, I'm guessing. Born and grew up in Edinburgh, but here we are. And so the summer I was in the house mostly on my own. My dad was up and down with work and things, but came to Christmas time and my mum had always said, didn't want a dog, et cetera. And here I was with a dog. So that conversation had to happen. And again, the sad thing is my hand was almost forced in having to explain the situation, which is good because it allowed me to actually share the situation with my family and ultimately give me the comfort I needed to do that further down the line with friends and publicly, et cetera. But I was still not comfortable actually sharing the fact I'd been viciously depressed and attempted suicide until I was forced to do so as a way to just keep the peace over Christmas. But doing so was one of the most liberating things I've ever done and has allowed the gaps to be filled from a family perspective, maybe when I was a bit miserable and they couldn't figure out why.
Do you think that they had an inkling what was going on, or did they just think that, oh, Fergus has done something mad and got a dog and what's going on here, what's happened? Or did they notice a change in you? And they must have.
Well, they were very surprised when I said what had happened. But again, I think it comes down to the fact that I'd just done such a good job of hiding
it, yeah.
And again, like getting to that is it's an extreme point to get to. It's an alarmingly common point to get to, but it is an extreme in most people's eyes. And that's largely down to the way that suicide is presented in the media and the way people consider it. Like, it's why I didn't want to use the word succeed, because the language around suicide is still quite ever developing in the world of the media and things. And I mean, there were periods where I'd see them and they knew I wasn't happy at uni, but I don't think they thought that it wasn't something I could just slog through. I think they always assume that the university, the academia was enough for me because that was that's what I thought. I therefore convinced them and they'd maintain that because they didn't have the internal feelings I did to make them think otherwise. And I wasn't telling them. So I don't blame them in any way for it, because I did a very, very good job of making it as I was just all smoke and mirrors on the phone. that was all I was for two and a bit years. And it was a shock to them. One that I don't think they really knew how to process to start with. But having spoken to a few of my university friends afterwards, when I ultimately, I mean, they didn't know in third year. They just thought I was some guy with a dog. And then 2018, I shared my story publicly as part of my first campaign. And they kind of said, we'd always kind of wondered, kind of had a bit of a deeper inkling as to why. Maybe they just thought that I was a bit lonely at points throughout university. They didn't think it had gotten to the stage that it did, because I was me. And that I was me logic was the whole reason I got to that stage in the first place. So but again, how soon could I have cut off all of my suffering had I had these conversations with people? Because from what I've seen with my own friends now, it's the ones that are doing the best or have the most weight on their shoulders or have the most change, or it's the ones that you least expect. It's the ones that conventionally you'd think everything's going well for them. But this is why it's so important to have the conversation, whether you are suffering or not, whether the person you're talking to about it is suffering or not, because one, they might be, but not be telling you. Two, they might be in the future, 3, you might be in the future. Mm. I mean, I'm under no illusions. At some point in my life, I will probably slip towards depression again. I'm just much better equipped now to know what to do. But just because I've been there and done that doesn't mean I'm not susceptible to the same things that got me there in the first place. I'm just more self-aware. So conversations, that the DNA and the vein that runs through all of this, it's not the end goal. It's not the end goal. It's not the end solution, because therapy, antidepressants, massive uphaul of the education system in terms of how it's presented, there's so many things to be done. But the thread that runs through all of it is open, honest conversation and actually destigmatizing the fact that talking about this is attached to your personality or your sense of being in any sense, because my vision for success was attached to my personality. So therefore, if that was deviated, I was worthless, I was a failure. And it's those distinctions are very important.
Just putting yourself into that headspace there with that thought process, you know, every achievement is a reflection of your worth, is a horrible place to be. And, you know, thank goodness you're in a position now where you can see things like that as, you know, irrational, but it doesn't help you at the time when that's your reality, that is your experience living and breathing every day. Practical advice for anybody, any young person listening right now, Fergus, that feels an affinity to the things that you went through, and are we all getting dogs, or is there anything else that we can do?
French bulldogs were cheaper than they are now when I got mine. So my recommendation is not for everybody to get a dog, but the premise behind how OD helped me recover is the same for everybody, in the sense that what it did was it helped me isolate what I was missing, what was causing me to, well, or what were the anchors that I needed to be able to actually start to take steps forward. And that was routine, structure, a better sleeping pattern, better eating pattern, some conversations, some socialization, spending time outside, actually exploring new places, speaking to somebody. Yeah. Nobody wasn't talking back to me, but I was still vocalizing things that I hadn't previously vocalized.
Did you sit and talk to him?
Oh, yeah. Well, I didn't, less sat there, but it was on long walks. I was just chatting rubbish as we were walking. There'll probably be some videos that pop up of me. Who's this guy walking through Jesmondine in 2016 talking to his dog? But I it was great. I could just have him off the lead because he was too scared to be far away from me at all. But I mean, it was a nightmare because I'd take him out for a 3 hours walk, which is too much for a puppy, but I was determined for him to go to the bathroom. 3 hours walk, he'd come in, he'd run into his crate and go to the bathroom in his crate. So,
of course he was.
It was a nightmare. But again, at the time, having to completely empty, strip out his crate, take it to the bath and spend the next 2 hours deep cleaning the flat as a result of it didn't bother me at all, because it was such a savior for me. But I think what that isolated was, I was missing habits, I was missing anchors in my day-to-day life. So solution number one is try and establish those anchors and those habits day-to-day ahead of time, and then focus on implementing them as much as you can in your day-to-day life, whether you're feeling great or not, because it basically raises the bar at which some bad news, some change, a bad exam result, a breakup, all these things could tip you towards a period of poor mental health. And I very much view it as a sliding scale, whereby if you're eating poor food, if you're not moving, if you're sedentary, then you're going to be on the sort of lower side of physical health, in the same way that if you're not fulfilled, if you're not having positive conversations, if you're not doing things that you enjoy, if you're a bit lost, then you're going to be on the lower side of your mental health. So there's things that we can do that push that scale in either direction on both sides. But anchors and habits and things that are important to you, number one, finding a sense of fulfillment, i.e. what do you really care about, and then do more of that. That's what I found in health and fitness whilst I was 17, whilst still at school. And that's something I carried through university. And that was the one thing I held on to, really.
Yeah, so that was your structure.
In an ironic, again, kind of sadistic way, it allowed me to suffer for much longer, which is a good and a bad thing, I guess, because without the training, things would have got worse faster. But all that did was make me miserable for longer. So I don't really know how to, you know what I mean? But that anchor, had I been more open and confident acknowledging the premise and understanding of mental health, the training probably would have kept me stable enough to be able to work backwards and recover without any external help, potentially, hypothetically, but that's the way I'm looking at it. And I think, though, finding fulfillment is difficult whilst you're at school because there's so many things being put in front of you. There's so many, oh, should I be doing what they're doing? So much comparison.
Yeah. And so much stuff that you just do because everybody's doing it and you have to just do it too. And I was talking to someone the other day and I said, at school, I don't remember even having a lunch break that was free or an after school that wasn't at some club doing something. you know, and I didn't even know if I liked the stuff. I was doing it.
Yeah, you're doing it. Yeah. But it's that institutionalized element that makes it makes us even more like susceptible to it when we leave school, because we are thrust out into a world where we can find that freedom a little bit more. Mm. So I think it's just being, it sounds completely trite. And believe me, if you told me this when I was 15 to 18, I would have told you to do one. But just every time you enjoy something, every time you don't enjoy something, just try and make a bit more of a mental note, be a bit more analytical about how you feel, how you respond to certain things. Mm. If there's a friendship group that you actually get home and think, you know what, maybe they aren't, maybe I didn't enjoy that as much as I thought I would, maybe then just start to think about how you can move away from that or what you can do more of. It's just being a little bit more conscious about what makes you tick, and then therefore building a toolbox, I call it, of things that you can keep close to you if you ever need to pull yourself out of a bit of a hole. Because my toolbox now is spending time outdoors, training, talking to Erin, my girlfriend, or friends, family, etc. I read. I'll, even if it's just a walk with a podcast in, I've got these things that I know if I'm struggling. I mean, I had a race 3 weeks ago, the full distance Ironman. And after that, I had two weeks of just being, just because I've just built up to this achievement.
Yeah.
With all these habits, with all this structure, then it's done. It's easy to say, well, I don't need those habits and those structures because I don't need to commit so hard anymore. But when those habits and structures fell away, everything fell away, because I suddenly lost what was keeping me together. It sounds like I'm ready to fall apart at any time, but the habits and the structures are what keep me moving forward, keep my energy high, keep me happy, keep me ticking over, and keep me stable and structured. So those are important, whether there is a big goal at the end of the road or not. And that's something that, again, as somebody who's self-aware, having gone through this, I've still had to remind myself of. And I had 2 weeks of being very fluid, but that wasn't good for me. So as of last week, I'm very much back to the habits and things that hold me down, because it's that reflection, being conscious of it. I very easily could have thought, well, I don't need to be doing this. So it's odd that I feel the way that I do. Let's just keep cracking on and see what happens. But self-awareness is important. I think kids in Scotland, I took it so much for granted when I was younger, but there is so much of Scotland that is just incredible. Makes the rest of the UK look pathetic. Wales and the Lake District has nothing on us.
True.
But it's something that can be very therapeutic. And it sounds when I was young, my parents laugh about this so much now, because whenever they'd say, oh, look at the view if we're on holiday, I'd just be like, what?
Yeah, sure.
The view? What are you talking about? Yeah. But spending time outdoors gets you away from that white noise and all the stuff that you're just doing and all the things that you feel you should be doing. It just allows you to actually be alone with your own thoughts or alone with friends, family, etc., without distraction. And I think it's very hard in this day and age to get time without distraction, because it's the one opportunity that we get to be able to actually sit and reflect on who we are. And as I said earlier, there's nobody better at being you than you. So just make the most of that, because you only get one opportunity to do so. Yeah. And if that means that you view yourself as weird, then embrace your weirdness. If that views you as doing this thing that doesn't fit in a certain box, then that's brilliant. You're creating a new box that other people might be able to fit themselves into in the future. But boxes don't exist to be put into. It's challenging, and it sounds much easier, as I said, than done. But the consciousness and the analysis in your own head that goes around it is what's important, I think. So it's just baby steps and conversations along the way.
Yeah, I mean, conversation is so key, but just that idea that you don't have to squeeze yourself into like the same mold that your mate's sitting pretty in, because that's not you. That's the whole point, you know?
Exactly.
But it's so hard at the time when you're going through, and probably, all you want to do is fit in.
They're probably wanting to go the other way as well. It's the same old, is that nobody's truly content, and what's the phrase? Comparison is the thief of joy, or whatever it is. And it's just social media makes that difficult, but my one tip there is to actually actively unfollow, actively block, actively remove what you digest on the internet. If you open up Instagram and something that pops up in your feed makes you feel negative or like you would like to be doing something, just unfollow, remove, because then social media can become a channel whereby you actually take inspiration from, you take positive thoughts from, and you then go and do positive things in your own life with that. But if you're just sitting scrolling through Instagram, TikTok, whatever, and just thinking, oh, I wish I was like that, I wish I was doing that, it's bordering on a form of psychological self-harm over time.
Like, I'm no good because I'm not that as well.
Exactly.
I must be awful because I can't do what they're doing, or I don't look the way that they look, or they are able to juggle social life, uni, whatever, when I'm overwhelmed by this one essay that I have to do right now, or this one thing that's on my mind.
Yeah.
And they're probably feeling the same.
I wish I could focus on one essay at a time. Like everybody wants to be doing something else, but it's once you're present and understand that the best version, you are completely unique, and that's a fantastic thing.
Yeah.
So it's embracing that, and it's that person that you're looking up to, comparing to, mm-hmm. will have somebody that they're looking up to, comparing to, and nobody's ever going to be away from that. And it's something that I've broken away from some degree. I mean, I still look at people and wonder how on earth they fit so much commercially, and how have they got so much done in such a short space of time. But
do they have a time turner?
Well, yeah, exactly. But it's then you actually piece it together, and they've got more financial resource, which has allowed them to hire a PA to take on the mundane tasks, from my perspective. But to put that into a younger person's perspective, which is only sort of 5-6 years ago for me now, and it's just a case of we all tick differently, but that's what's best about us, because it allows us to offer different things to the world. And that's an opportunity rather than a negative, because what's the point in us all just being robots that do the same thing, sit in the same boxes, try and do the same things, put up the same content, do the same essay? It's that's what makes the world go around.
How dull would that, especially for the person marking those essays? Can you imagine, like, 8 million essays that are all identical,
so
we've all ticked the same way? I think it's interesting talking to you about, I think there's a lot of parallels. Certainly, personally, I commend you so much for being so open and so vocal about your experience, because it's something that only recently have I even began to think about opening up about. It's quite strikingly similar in a lot of ways, with it being a university thing that was a big shift for me. Any advice to anyone going through that kind of state of flux where everything's changed and they're in the same headspace you were, sitting in a probably dingy university hall?
It was dingy. Yeah. No, I can't confirm.
Some of these rooms are actually not much bigger than prison cells.
No. Yeah. With probably equipment from the same wholesaler. Yeah. I mean, first one is, don't be afraid to, I don't want to say push the boat out because it's such a cliche, but don't be afraid to look a little further. I mean, halls is one element of university. You've got your course, you've got, if you play sport,
so many
clubs, so many things, but it's very easy to think, too many clubs probably, actually.
Yep.
But it's which can be overwhelming. And that state of being overwhelmed can very easily have a bit of a domino effect where it just pushes you into this corner where you think, actually, I can't do anything. Mm. But for example, I didn't have anyone. I did try on my course to connect with people. That fell by the wayside. Because, I mean, the majority of them were Scripture Union.
Because you weren't interested in the course.
Yeah, and I mean, the majority of them were, 80% of them were avid Scripture Union which is fantastic. But they had a community that came onto the course. So they were very much in and out, whereas that wasn't a part of my life. Mm-hmm. And the sport I was competing in, an individual sport, tried to start a club for that sport, but was told there was no space in the performance center at the gym.
You're trying to do all the right things.
Exactly. But I kept getting cut off, and one too many times just made me think, well, there's nothing I can do. But had I thought, you know what, just play a bit of recreational rugby again, I would have met a whole load of people. A whole load of people I then became friends with in the third year, I would have met in the first 6 weeks. That's the way it works out. But it was a case of, oh, well, this hasn't worked, so therefore that won't work. But it's again, very much easier said than done. But don't be afraid to try new things. Actively try new things. If you're struggling and the change feels overwhelming, try and find familiars, I think I'd call them. So things that you'd use or do on a day-to-day basis before the change, and then try and manifest that into your current existence. So whether that's getting up at a certain time each morning, having the same breakfast, or whether you miss your mum making you something in the morning, phone her and have that same thing for breakfast.
Get mum's mac and cheese recipe,
yeah, that's it.
For goodness sake. Honestly, I remember really vividly in like second year uni just phoning my mum and saying, right, I'm doing it all wrong. You have to talk me through it. This is going to really help me today. You know, she was in Aberdeen and I'm in Glasgow, and I was like, I need you now. I need mac and cheese. I need your mac and cheese.
Did it work? Right, did you get there?
It did. It helped. And now I know how to make it perfectly, just like Jane.
But again, like, as part of that, you're on the phone to her, you were connecting with somebody when probably you wouldn't have been able to speak to anyone else about that. You then brought a bit of home to university. So it just bridges that gap, because we don't want to be, there's people listening to this that might think, well, then I'm not moving far enough away from home and I'm not embracing it enough. And then there'll be people that may be put off because university feels so far away from home. But it's up to you how much you stretch that. And I think finding familiars is important, not being afraid to try the innumerable amount of things that are on offer to you at university, but also accepting that because something doesn't work, that doesn't mean it's inherently bad. That doesn't mean that you've made a mistake. All it means is that you get the opportunities to try again. And that means that there are infinite possibilities to find your tribe, university, I think, or out of university, depending on what direction you go in. But as from somebody that's been there and mm-hmm. known exactly what it feels like to think, oh, well, that hasn't worked, so therefore this won't work. Just keep trying, because you will strike gold. And I almost went offline for 2 years. And then the second I came back online, shall we say, weird terminology, but I'm going to run with it, in third year, I found the people that I then lived with in the third year, spent a lot of time with and had a great time with, and I'm seeing them a week today in London. So it's just like, yeah. that's the way it's worked. But it's only because I shut myself off to the opportunity rather than the other way around. But I acknowledge that it's very easy for that sense of overwhelm, being overwhelmed, to sort of wear you down a little bit.
But it's so hard when you feel like you're chapping on doors and they're getting shut in your face. And then you look at it retrospectively, and sometimes you go, was I trying hard enough? And yeah, you were, because if you felt like at the time that you were giving your everything, that's your truth. That's what was happening to you. That's how burnout happens, I suppose, when you just go, nah, sack this. I've exhausted all potential here. I'm done. And I suppose that's when you hope that whether it's lecturers or teachers or pals, someone spots that and asks the question and reaches out and tries to kind of understand what's going on. Do you have any advice, Fergus, for anyone who maybe is watching their friend, or they've maybe their friend's moved or gone to uni or gone to college, whatever they've done, started a new job, and they haven't heard from them in a while, and they're worried if they're not getting on all right?
Yeah, I think the main thing is not to go on the offensive by saying, look, I'm worried about you and all this stuff. I think that can easily push people further away and make them defensive in turn. There's a principle called the ALGI principle, which the Mental Health First Aid England, Scotland, Wales and Ireland use. It's ALGI, so it's ALGEE, and it's ask how they're doing, listen non-judgmentally, give proactive advice. So whether that's to speak to somebody or to go elsewhere, depending on the severity of how they're feeling. What's the fourth one? I think it's engage in some variety. I should probably have had this up beforehand. But basically the premise is, look it up. The ALGI principle is a great one. ALEC by Movember is one you can use as well. But all it is a neat way of remembering the flow in which you should approach it with somebody if you are genuinely concerned, because they're ultimately in a state of psychological distress. Yeah. So in the same way, if somebody's got a broken arm, the last thing you want to do is try and put their arm back. If somebody's psychologically in a similar position, then you're not going to be able to just fix it like that. There's a bit more of a process to it. So ALGI principle and ALEC, basically ask without covering too much. Make sure you listen. That's a key word we haven't used too much yet. Then engage, open a bit of a dialogue, push them in the direction they need to if it requires professional, if it requires a bit of external help, and then continue to check in is the most important thing. Because as I said earlier, it's not a case of the job is done. Once you are no longer suffering with depression, that means that you are at some point in the future susceptible to it, because we live in a very fluid, changing world. And that means that we're always susceptible to things knocking us for six and putting us in crisis. But yeah, the main thing I think would be to just keep in touch with people. If you're not hearing from them, if they don't see themselves, just keep in touch and sort of make sure they're aware that you are there if they need to talk. Don't constantly remind, I say again, especially from a masculine perspective, it can easily push you further away if you're constantly presenting yourself as, oh, I'm here to help, I'm here to help, here to help. But if you're subconsciously saying, how are you doing, what you've been up to, or how was that rugby match, how was that football game,
let's go for a walk, let's go for a coffee, which we're much better at now.
We are, yeah. And we can do, which is nice, now that we're back in some sense of normality.
Yeah. Do you think that someone coming up to you and saying, hey, Fergus, something's not right, are you okay, would have got your back up at the time?
Yeah, 100%. 100%. Yeah. I would have over-indexed on telling them how okay I was.
The performance would have kicked in.
Yeah, it would. Yeah.
Sometimes I think we should all have done drama.
I know. Yeah, no.
Because that's what's so scary about it.
That's what I basically did for 2 years, to be fair. I was studying theology, but practicing drama.
Theatre.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness. You touched slightly there on masculinity. Do you think that the kind of toxic masculinity portrait has a lot to answer for in this scenario?
I don't love the phrase, because I think it just means different things depending which mainstream media outlet you're listening to.
Sure, given
but
which.
The premise, in my mind, that there's two sides to it. There's external toxic masculinity, which is, I don't know, the side of misogyny, patriarchy we need to do away with, which I 100% agree, something that needs to be changed imminently. Mm-hmm. And then there's the internal toxic masculinity, which I think is a product of society and its tradition on what, again, the box that a man should be. So it was something that I very much fell into, and that I should be strong, resilient, infallible. I should earn more money than anyone else in the household. I should be successful by this age. I should be able to do this. I should be able to do that.
Make your entire family proud right now.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. But don't falter along the way in any way. Otherwise, you're less of a man and actually there's somebody doing better than you. Yeah. And that is changing, I think. And there's lots of people. I mean, part of what I do now is I try to do things that I think you can denote the word strength to whilst talking about the mental health stuff openly, because then that kind of breaks down the weakness versus strength narrative that can sometimes fall into that traditional version of masculinity. But there's also ex-special forces soldiers, professional footballers, professional rugby players, all these men that are much harder than you think you are, saying, actually, I am suffering and it's okay to suffer. And actually, part of why I'm suffering is what's making me a better version of myself moving forwards. And it's all it is a bump in the road. It's a character building exercise. And I count myself lucky. It's a strange thing to say, but I count myself lucky, fortunate for having come through the other side of what I did, because I'm now much more self-aware, much more attuned to what can send me in either direction, and just much more switched on to what I should be doing on a day-to-day basis to keep myself happy. But I've only got there through learning the hard way. But these conversations and actually eroding that toxically masculine, this is the pathway you should take, is a big step in the right direction. But I do think we made leaps and bounds since I was at school in that.
Well, I think even just talking about the positive role models and people having the honest conversation, it's brilliant. You know, and the conversation doesn't stop and it's good. It's just, I suppose it's just what we do from that jumping off point. Now people are more willing to talk about it. You know, we still have a big issue to tackle here. It's, you know, most young people will experience poor mental health at some point in their life. And if it's not happened yet, it might be something that you have to encounter later on. And I think it's understanding that you're not alone and there is a framework that you can use to try and help yourself. And also don't feel bad if you can't help yourself in that moment, because that's why professional help is out there. And that's why we keep talking about it, so that people know that they can go and access that support without shame.
I mean, on Saturday, for example, what was the day? Monday. It's Saturday. I had to self-isolate until Saturday at midnight because my girlfriend was positive. I wasn't. But I've got everything I need in the house to be able to train. Part of how I make a living is with my training. And I've got everything in the house other than an endless swimming pool to be able to swim. So that was the only thing that I was limited to doing. I know. Nightmare.
Soon.
Nightmare. The cost difference between everything I have to that is rather alarming. But I've got a gym I can use, I've got a static bike, and I've got a treadmill in the house, because that's all part of the things that I train for. And I've had to do a full week of training indoors, and I do about 18 to 22 hours of training a week. I've had to do all my work at my desk. I've had to, all shopping's been done over the internet. And these are all things, again, throughout the week, at no stage did I feel like I was struggling. I was doing everything that I would normally do on a day-to-day basis. And then Saturday, I was 35 minutes into what was meant to be a 3-hour training session on the bike and the treadmill. And I just had just this complete haze of burnout, being annoyed, being stressed, thinking I can't be bothered doing this. What's the point? Just go next door. Just because I'd been locked up for 10 days and I'd been convincing myself that I could just fight through it because I'm in control of the parameters, etc. But here's me, somebody who's been through a suicide attempt, come out of the side, talks about this publicly, has done a lot of charity campaigns, speaking to others about how they manage it. And here I am still making mistakes and will continue to make mistakes at this stage. But what happened then was I, rather than slogging through it and making myself miserable for 3 hours, I just got off the bike and put it down to one of those things. Cleared my desk, because I normally do a fair amount of work on the weekends as well, just whenever I've got time. But just cleared my desk for the weekend, so I'm not going to do anything until Monday morning. Mowed the lawn, then just spent the rest of the evening just with Erin doing stuff around the house, just because it was complete decompression.
Yeah.
And that's the key thing, is that I was presented with a situation that I didn't see it coming. No, I didn't see it coming. But I acknowledged where I'd went wrong, did something proactive. And as of this morning, I'm back to my normal routine and feel great. And I'm out of the house doing things again, which means that I know I'll be fine. So it's a case of, you're never going to get it right all the time. But the more that you do the right things, the better prepared you'll be for when they go wrong. And if the past year has shown us anything, it's that a curveball can be chucked your way at any stage. And there's lots of things we can do on a day-to-day basis that will better prepare us for when things go south in some way, that means that it won't send us into a spiral that, as you've said, at some stage in our life, it'd be very odd if we didn't end up in some way or another.
Yeah. I suppose the isolation situation is really the only thing I can think of in my life that has been like when I've been going through a bout of depression, because I have actively closed the door for
100%, 10 days. Yeah.
You know, and that's,
for you, for someone who kind of is in a state where you're living well and managing your mental health in a really positive and inspiring way, to be put back in that box must have been quite concerning. I don't know, it's a weird one.
I mean, I had Erin, I had the dogs.
Yeah,
I had,
but it's, it, you know, it's, yeah, it's a strange...
But it's, again, it was probably, I didn't confront it like that. I didn't consider it like that until it had tanked me.
Yeah.
So it's, again, I'm still defaulting a little bit to that almost keep calm and carry on British element in me.
Yeah.
Where you just kind of slog through things. But that's a part of me that's now developed to a point where it means that I know when there's a difference between pushing beyond my means and pushing for development or developing resilience, or just because I'm busy and I need to get this done within this time frame, and then I can switch off a little bit. But yeah, previously it would have been under all circumstances, do everything you've set out to do. No questions asked, otherwise you are useless. Whereas now it's, okay, well, circumstances have changed. There's things out with your control. You know what? Hasn't gone your way this time. What do you do next is what matters. And that's kind of the way I live my life, is whenever I'm presented with something that, whether I can control it or I can't, it doesn't matter. It's what do I do next? And if it's something that's out with my control, then if I can't do anything about it, I can't do anything about it. Move on in some way. But if there is, then I'll try and bring that into what I can do and then just change my own circumstances or environment to better manage it. But again, I've come to that through a negative experience. I'm not saying everybody needs to go through a negative experience to be able to do that. But through that consciousness, that bit more self-analysis, doing more of the things that make you feel happy, doing less of the things that make you feel a bit sad or lost or confused or lacking direction, what you digest in terms of content online, who you follow, the people you engage with, the people you spend time with, and exploring more of what makes you a unique individual, the sooner you can come to that self-awareness that will allow you to manage your own mental health to a point. Obviously, there's elements and things that can happen in life that might mean you need external help, but it comes back to that sliding scale element. There's things that we can do to keep us on the positive side, and there's things that we can do to put us on the negative side. So it's up to us to try and do that, and it's very much easier said than done. But I think amongst your peers, you can all sort of put a bit of an effort together to look after one another more openly than you could do previously, and you'll be better off for it. You'll probably be more successful in whatever your definition of the term is in the future, because for me, success now is nothing to do with bank account. It's all about happiness and who I get to spend time with on a day-to-day basis.
And in that moment on that Saturday afternoon, the thing that you needed to do was three of you to sit down,
that was it. I've actually got two dogs now as well, so it was four of us.
Whoa.
But it was that was it. But it was to not be hard on myself for needing that in that moment. Because I run my own businesses, I've got my training, and they're all sort of singing into the same arena. But it means that I've got a lot on my I've got a lot on my plate at all times, and that's stressful. But I enjoy it, and it means that I therefore need to be even more self aware of when things are going wrong. Because if I fall apart, those things fall apart as well. Because I'm the sort of the key component of all of them, but. If Fergus from 2014 to 2016 was in this position, there'd be no business in 6 months. Mm. There'd be no relationship in 6 months. I'd be miserable and I'd be doing different things out of desperately looking for some way of making myself happy. But it's just reframing how I consider things. And that distinction between success being job, prestige, bank account, holidays, car, house, all that rubbish, to happiness and how much time do I get to spend with the people I love doing the things that I enjoy doing. That's quite literally my definition, is how much time I can spend with the people that I care about doing the things that I enjoy doing. It's freed me to be a better version of me long term, and I've come to that at 25. Well, I've felt that since probably 22 23, but which is younger than most, I'd imagine, but from a negative experience. But what that does is allows me to be much more in control of how I want to live the rest of my life from an overall happiness point of view. And I've only got there through ruthlessly monitoring what makes me feel positive, negative, and trying to be able to listen and communicate with others around me so that they can feel the same. Try to, at least.
I mean, you say it's younger than most, but the amount of work that you've put in that time, from a horrific ordeal to where you are now, I mean, that's probably, you know, I'm talking in dog years now, it's probably like hundreds of years. It's crazy how much you've managed to achieve in that time. And hopefully we're in a position where people, without having the negative experience, from 15, know that that's what's most important. From 13, know that that's most important.
I hope so. And a big driving factor for me is that I want to have kids at some point, and it makes me very, very, very fearful that any children I have could feel the way that I do as a result of the society in which we live. So it's kind of I want to try and reframe that narrative as much as possible so that I don't need to be fighting against that narrative by
that
the time
current as a parent.
Yeah, exactly, yeah, exactly.
And knowing what's going on in your kid's head, because you know better than most.
And I think a key element of this as well is my parents' generation don't necessarily understand these conversations. My parents understand it much better now as a result of what I've done with the charity work and everything. Yeah. But before that, they were still using language that was probably perpetuating that toxic masculinity, the sort of traditional notions of success, all that stuff. And I think having a sit-down conversation with your parents about your understanding of your mental health, their mental health, what they can all do to improve it on a day-to-day basis as a household, etc., would be a positive thing to do, because it just brings the thought provocation to them. Because you're not going to, I mean, unless you've got a PhD, you're not going to be able to lay out the statistics and the analysis of why we feel the way that we do. But what you can do is you can help them understand how
you need and what would help you and your friends. And yeah. Just, oh, by the way, don't tell me to man up today, Mum.
Yeah, exactly.
Things like that, really stamping out that language is so important. It's so crucial.
Yeah, and just understanding the connotations that go with that, because, I mean, man up's a great example. Man up implies that you are not allowed to show emotion. I know, it comes back to that, I know special forces soldiers that will have been told to man up in times gone by, but they're the most resilient people on the planet.
Yeah.
Yet they're still here saying, I'm susceptible to this and it's up to me to manage this. So it's just, if somebody is feeling rough, their personality is attached to their success, their grades, whatever it is, and they can't detach those things, then telling somebody to man up can be the worst thing you can say to them, because it can make them feel even further away from where they want to be. Yeah. So it's just opening that conversation, but having an open dialogue in your household. And some parents might not be completely open to it, but it's up to you to try and drip feed that conversation a little bit more and just promote that self-awareness, mm-hmm. because they care about you, and whether they understand it or not, they do care about you, and that's not going to change. So it's how do we bridge the gap so that everybody understands and can communicate it proactively from here on out, so that there's less situations that where external help is needed, there's less suicide statistics sort of plaguing our computer screens, and it's everything between now and then that's important.
So important. And I think if anybody listening to this wants to brave a conversation over a cup of tea with their mum and dad tonight, I wish you luck, and I think it'll probably go a lot better than you think it's going to go. So just do it. Just have the chat and just tell them how you feel and what's going on. Fergus, finally, you know, just on that kind of note of having the conversation, do you have a kind of final message for anyone who might be going through a difficult time right now and hasn't been able to talk to anyone yet about how to broach that conversation, whether it is parents or friends or whoever it might be?
Yeah, I think it's not a mantra as such, but it's something I recount to myself when I've been 6 out of 11 days deep onto ultra endurance challenges and things, and
so relatable.
But it's the same sort of level of suffering, in the sense that all I say is no one feeling lasts forever. Mm. And that applies to happiness as well as sadness, but the way that you feel now isn't the way that you'll feel in the future, and that's something that I could not comprehend when I felt as bad as I did. But now, if you told me I feel the way that I do on a day-to-day basis now to Fergus then, I would have laughed in your face. So I think no one feeling lasts forever is number one, but two, the access that you have to people you can talk to is probably much wider than you think. Calm have a hotline, which is fantastic, that you can speak to. Papyrus have a hotline, I believe, for young people specifically. Mine might have one as well, and the Samaritans.
Yeah, we've got some numbers actually to put out at the end of this podcast.
There are more resources that if you're not yet comfortable sharing even a superficial level, well, a superficial account of how you're feeling, there are resources out there that you might not be aware of that can help you do that. And from personal experience, having that first conversation might be enough to get you to the stage where you can actually say, look, Mum, I'm desperate here. Can we talk about this? But you might not even need to, in that first conversation, explain everything about how you're feeling. It might just be a look, I need help. Can we go for a walk? Can we go to my favorite beach? Can we get that fish and chips from where we went when I was 12? Whatever yeah. it is, it doesn't matter. Yeah. But it's just the domino effect of acknowledging within yourself how you're feeling, acknowledging that vocally, even if it's writing it down to start with, that is getting it out of you in some way. And I think that's a very useful exercise. For me, that was talking to Odie as we were walking. As I said things, I was literally almost like reaching out to grab them and put them back in my mouth. But obviously, you can't do that for those that are... aware, but it was that practice allowed me to actually realize internally what was going on. Realizing internally allowed me to actually take action. Taking action allowed me to ultimately talk about it. Talking about it with my family allowed me to talk about it with my friends. Talking about it with my friends allowed me to talk about it publicly with the charity campaign. Mm. And then doing that allowed me to talk about it publicly on national television. So it's like the step changes there are quite clear, but yeah. Taking the first step is the most important thing. But there are resources that allow you to enter that at pretty much any stage that anybody might be in, which is fantastic. But it's a very difficult thing to do. So I think writing, thinking about it first, how you want to approach it, is a great place to start. But I say again, this feeling will pass. No one feeling lasts forever, and things will improve, whether it's now, whether it's tomorrow, whether it's a week from now, they will improve. But there are things you can do between now and then to help get you there sooner rather than later.
Fergus, thank you so much for your openness and your, so much valuable advice in there. And I just really hope that someone listening today kind of takes that on board and just, if anything, knows that they're not alone, and like the situation might pass, the feeling might pass, but only you're responsible for building that structure to, like you say, make sure that you're equipped to deal with it.
100%. And embrace who you are, because you're the best at being you. Nobody can do you better.
Thanks for listening. If you've identified with anything you've heard today, there is so much help out there for you. If you need to speak to someone now, you can contact Childline by calling 0800 1111, the Samaritans by calling 116 123, or Shout by texting Shout to 85258. Please also head to Young Scots I Feel page at young.scot/I feel for plenty of info, support and activities that you can access right now. Remember, your feelings are valid and you are never alone. There is always a way through, no matter how bad things might get. And we've got lots more subjects to cover in this series, so I can't wait to see you again for episode 4. In the meantime, hit subscribe to get instant access as soon as it drops. And please don't forget to share this episode with a pal who may need to hear it.